Continuing on with Revelation chapter 3, we discussed last week the Church of Philadelphia, and I know I said, hey, we're going to do one of these per week, and that's always the intent. But there's so much stuff in the one to Philadelphia that I wanted to just emphasize a few things of where we were at last week, because there's just a lot of things that are going on in here. So just to review, we were talking about this concept where it says, he who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens, says this. And we talked about that. We went through this concept of the key of David. And let's head back to Isaiah 22, because Diane came up to me afterwards and said she had a question. And when she asked the question, I realized I was wrong on something. So I wanted to fix it. Because that does happen. It's all recorded. Yeah, I was wrong, and it's not the first time. And I guarantee you, it's probably gonna be the last. No, it won't be the last time. It won't be the last time. I guarantee that. The interpretation of Isaiah 22 is dealing with this one guy Shebna, who was the steward of the house of David. God was going to remove him, and he was going to install a guy named Eliakim, who was going to end up being the steward of the house of David. And it states about this guy in verse number 22. He says, "Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. I will drive him like a peg or a nail in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory on his father's house. So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offering an issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars." So he's making a statement that this guy Eliakim is going to be installed as the steward, and God's going to put him like a nail in a firm place. And that word nail is also used over in Zechariah to describe the Messiah. Now, the interpretation is that this is referring to Eliakim in chapter 22. By application and by what Jesus says, he's saying that this key of David that Eliakim was given, he's actually the one who's the rightful owner of this, who's going to open and no one will shut. So like we see in a lot of other things in the Old Testament, Eliakim is a type. He's not the fulfillment. He's a type. And one of the ways that we can tell that this is a type is, this is the question that Diane had last week. And when I looked at it, I'm like, yeah, she's right. Because I actually misread this when I was going over it. Verse 25, it says, "In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way, and it will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken." Now, that's obviously not talking about Jesus. That's talking about Eliakim. And my interpretation of that is that the house of David didn't persist. It didn't continue to go on, did it? It was cut off. And this concept of Eliakim and the steward being a nail put in a firm place and the glory was going to hang on them, boy, that didn't happen for very long, did it? It got shut down and the line ended. And after Zedekiah, there was no king on the throne of David until Jesus Christ came. So I think that's what he's talking about there. It's going to fail. It's going to break. But again, like all typology fails, doesn't it? Otherwise, it would be the fulfillment. The sacrifices, that's a type. Did they continue? No. The kingship, did that continue? No. The priesthood, did that continue? No. The old covenant, the law, the covenant of law, that doesn't continue for the Christian, does it? No, not at all. So what this is talking about is that that type is going to stop and fail too. Now, when Jesus picks up this imagery again, in Revelation chapter 3, so let's go back to there. He's using this imagery to say, that was a type that failed. Mine doesn't. I'm the one who actually has the authority of the throne of David. And I'm the one that has that key. I'm that nail driven in a firm place, just like it says back in the book of Zechariah, where it talks about him being the cornerstone, the nail, the battle bow. All of those things are relating to Christ. he's that firm nail driven in a place. And we'll ask you this. If Jesus drives himself as a nail in a firm place, is there anyone that's going to pull him out? No. All that glory is going to rest on him, and it's going to stay resting on him. And so when he has a door that's shut and he opens it, or when he has a door that's open, he shuts the door, no one's going to open it. If he opens the door, no one's going to shut it. And that's the whole point of this. With the house of David, that didn't persist. That might happen for a little while there's somebody there that has faith. But when somebody arises that doesn't have faith, which happened frequently, that concept wasn't going to continue. So I was off on that last verse there. I think I said that was not referring to Eliakim, but obviously it was. So I appreciate Diane bringing that up. Anybody got any questions or comments on that? All right, let's continue in chapter 3 then of Revelation. Again, to continue with the review, the concept of verse 8, he says, I know your deeds. Behold, I put before you an open door which no one will shut because you have a little power and have kept my word, have not denied my name. Yeah, we did go over that. The concept of a little power. Obviously, there was something going on in Philadelphia where these guys didn't have a lot of power, influence, whether it was money. And I think it had something to do with wealth because of the way that he takes Sardis and Laodicea and hits them the way that he does. In other words, I don't think it was dealing with faith. Because he says, I know your deeds. And he says, you've kept my word, have not denied my name. See, that's faith, isn't it? That's faith in action. So I don't think the power that he's talking about is you don't have any power of faith. You don't have any love, because he doesn't say anything negative about this church. If they didn't have love, would he have called them out on it? Sure did. He called out the Ephesians, right? If they tolerated evil teachers, would he have called them out on that? Yep, he would have. But you see, he didn't call them out on anything. If they had a name like they were alive but were actually dead, or if they were wealthy and relied on that, he would have called them out. But instead, he doesn't call them out for anything. In other words, this church and this type of congregation has all the things clicking the way that it needs to be. Based upon what he says to the other churches, I think that their love was on point, their faith was on point, their works were on point. They were just small, and they didn't have a lot of physical power that would translate into prestige, that would translate into control or influence in any way, shape, or form. This was probably what we would like consider just a small little faithful congregation that's out there doing what they can do, pushing forward with the gospel and trying to make things right in the world, trying to bring people to Christ. But maybe they weren't making a ton of headway. And so what he's about to tell them is, he says, look, I have put before you an open door. And the way that is written in the Greek is that I've already done it. It's already open, and it's continuing to stay open. So he's letting them know, you don't have a lot of power. Maybe you haven't made a lot of headway. Maybe you haven't, a lot of things haven't been happening the way that you've wanted them to happen. I'm telling you, that's changing. You know, if you think about the way things operate in the world, and especially with the church, things don't stay steady, do they? Sometimes there's a season of plenty. Sometimes there's a season of want. Sometimes things go forth quickly. Sometimes you have to work really hard to gain an inch. Sometimes our lives are like that too. Depending upon the onslaught, spiritual onslaught that's coming against us, sometimes holding fast is actually progress. Sometimes standing your ground is actually moving forward. Because everybody, you know, if you think about it, if you're planted firmly and everybody else is getting washed backwards in the sea, you're actually the one making progress, aren't you? Because everybody else is backwards. So sometimes standing firm is progress. But other times, it's like we're light on our feet, we're moving forward rapidly, things are going great. And then sometimes things stop going great and we wonder, what's going on? What did I do wrong? Why is God... No. It's never always going to be like that. You have to recognize that if it's always forward momentum, we're going to get weak. We're going to get complacent, possibly. We need there to be challenges. And like typically, this is bleeding into my message for second hour. Because Paul, I think, is a great example of this. You know, sometimes Jesus had thousands of people surrounding him and the crowds were great and they were shouting his name and they were excited about him. Sometimes Jesus was almost dying and he has to take off and go and be by himself for a while. All that stuff's necessary. So I just want to encourage you that sometimes progress is really fast. Sometimes it's a little bit slow. Sometimes the forces against us are so strong that just standing your ground is what needs to happen. But we also need not be confused about something and think that maybe just because I'm standing fast, I'm not losing ground, but I'm not gaining ground, I'm doing what I'm supposed to. Maybe we just need to push a little bit harder too. Right? So no matter what, energy, spiritual energy, physical energy is needing to be exerted in our lives, in our faith. Right? We have to combat physical entropy. We have to combat spiritual entropy. It's just the way it is. Things definitely want to move from a state of organization to a state of chaos, to a state of, from a state of high energy to a state of low energy. That's what entropy is. Specifically with heat, but I'm not here to talk about physics, but the energy makes sense. So for us, there's always a force trying to push us back. So we always need to be pushing forward. That can get tiring. I get it. But there's nothing else in this life worth it at all. As we start to see things become very chaotic and uncertain in the world right now. And, you know, things always have a way of working out, at least they have in the past. But we understand one of these days it's not going to work out, right? That's just, you go back and look at history. Things just go. They move forward until one day everything changes. Everything resets and then it moves forward. We just happen to work with bigger stakes these days. You know, unfortunately. But everything could become normal again, and we just continue before. Either way, we move forward. So I think that's what he's talking about there. And because they have a little power, because they've kept his word and have not denied his name, God's put forth an open door. The only way we're going to know if a door is open or not is by trying to go through it. The only way you know if a door is unlocked is by turning the knob. It's the only way. So regardless of what's going on, we're continuing to move forward and turn the knob. Because I guarantee you, if we see all the stuff going crazy in the world, other people are seeing things going crazy in the world, and sometimes people start to wake up, and that's when we need to be there. So we need to make sure that we're engaging. Questions or comments before we move on? All right, let's go to verse number 9. He says, "Behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, I will make them come and bow down at your feet and make them know that I have loved you." Now, this is an interesting verse because it corresponds back, if we go back to Smyrna in verse number 9, He says, I know your tribulation, your poverty, but you are rich. The blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. So it seems to me that there is a concerted effort in at least two of these instances for this specific context where Jews are going after Christians. And we see that in the first century. It's a tremendous push against the Jewish nation. And it seems like now it's even more targeted at these Christians. And so you go back and you try to think of the answer as to why that is. Well, when the destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD, and the Christians are out there saying this is the fulfillment of Matthew 24, how do you think the Jews would react to that? Not good. They want to shut these guys up. So they go after and they persecute. They collaborate with the Romans to destroy the Christians. And that's exactly what was happening. Now remember, a lot of the Christians in these churches would have been ethnic and physical Jews who converted from Judaism to Christianity. So their ties into that community would have been very, very steep and deep. Now, you go back and look at how God dealt with the Jews during that time frame. It's very interesting. Of course, we know about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. 1.1 million Jews died in that destruction, most by famine and the civil war. There was another small skirmish after that, and then in between 132 and 135, there was a rebellion, and some of you might have heard of it, called the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. This man named Bar Kokhba was a military leader. He came up. The Jews thought he was the Messiah, and he inflicted some damage upon the Romans. And then the Romans came and finally wiped those guys out, and 600,000 died there. So from 70 AD, now think about this, from 70 AD to 135 AD, right? So about 60 years, 1.8, roughly, with the small skirmish in there, about 1.8 million Jews died. The nation wasn't that big to begin with. And from that point forward, they pretty much, I mean, they don't completely disappear, because in the fourth century, so everybody knows Constantine, right? The Roman emperor who made Christianity legal. His sons did the same thing, continued on. After that little dynasty went away, there was another Roman emperor by the name of Julian. And here's how the Christian history has called him. He's called Julian the Apostate. So what he decided to do was to undo a lot of the reforms that came about with Constantine and his sons. And what he also decided to do was to partner with the Jews to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Now, here's what's interesting. I know some of you like history. If you don't, you can go to sleep and wake up in about 5 minutes. So what he did is he partnered with the Jews. And so you had a Roman-Jewish coalition of rebuilding the temple back in Jerusalem in the fourth century. They cleared off it from everything that you see. It seems like they cleared off all the rubble and they were starting to work on the foundations. And then something happened. Several things happened. Now, this comes not only from Christian sources. One guy, his name is Cyril of Jerusalem. If you've listened to the podcast, we talk about him a couple of times. He was actually in Jerusalem at this time. But then there's also a Roman historian that verifies this as well. This is going to sound a little bit crazy, but again, there's like two or three sources from different perspectives that have no reason to collaborate or lie, talked about these things. And I'm still researching it, but this is what I found so far. That when they were starting to rebuild the foundation, fire would start to spring up from the foundation and destroy and kill the workers. There's talk about fireballs that they have no idea where they came from, killing people, earthquakes, all kinds of things, that the workers were so terrified that they stopped work and it never went forward. And so you think, okay, this could be mythology. This could just be legend that was created. But God's done this stuff before. He promised that Babylon would never be rebuilt. The guy who tried to rebuild it after it was destroyed a bit was Alexander the Great, and he died very quickly. There were a few other folks that tried to rebuild it through the years, and they all died. The last guy who tried to rebuild it was Saddam Hussein. And what happened to him? He was hung by the neck until dead. So my point is, if God says something's not going to be rebuilt, it's not going to be rebuilt. He did the same thing with Jericho. He said, okay, you guys can rebuild Jericho, but the guy who does it, and I think this is prophesying about what was going to happen, he goes, he's going to lose his first son when he lays the foundation. He's going to lose his last son when he finishes up. That's exactly what happened. Scripture lays that out. See? So my point is that if God's like, temple's destroyed, it's not going to be rebuilt. It's not going to be rebuilt. They might try, but I don't think it's going to happen. Now, and God never said the temple wasn't going to be built. So if it does get rebuilt in Jerusalem, that's fine. It's not going to change my faith one single bit. But I find it interesting that God allowed a Muslim mosque to be built on that spot. And if anybody tried to do anything, there are a billion Muslims in the world. You would have 100 million of them knocking on the door of Jerusalem to make that not happen. They might get the tabernacle up for a little bit, but I tell you what, there is not going to be any you know, multi-year temple project going on in that particular instance. Not the way things stand right now. My whole point is this. How does God define the Jews in Revelation 2 and 3? This is what he calls them. I'm not calling them this. That's what he's calling them. And even God, he lets us know very clearly in Romans chapter 11, which gets thrown around a lot by dispensationalists, God has not rejected his people, has he? May it never be. No, he hasn't. But like everything, we got to keep reading, don't we? And Paul says, I'm a Jew. The whole point of what he's saying is this. He's an Israelite. He's a Christian. If God had actually rejected his people, Jews couldn't become Christians. But because God had not rejected his people, they could become Christians. And that's why he says a little bit later on, he talks about the remnant in chapter 11. And he says, it's always going to be the remnant that's saved. The only Jews that can be saved today. Let's not even talk about whether or not they're actually related to the 12 tribes, because that's a huge issue, but we won't get into that. The only way is if they come to Christ, just like everybody else. You want to know how somebody wouldn't be part of the synagogue of Satan in Philadelphia or Smyrna? It's if they became Christians. It's the only way. My point is, if you have somebody that says that someone who is a Jew has a right relationship with Christ or with God outside of Christ, that is patently false. And he calls those people this who think that they are Jews. And notice what he says, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Because who are the true Jews after the coming of Christ? Christians. Anyone else who's saying, I am a true spiritual Jew, and I have a right relationship with God through, especially at this time, through Moses and the law, is lying. The only people, no matter ethnicity, from the time Jesus Christ, from the time Pentecost started, the only people who had the right relationship were the people in Christ. Now, God gave them grace because, I mean, what are Jews in Ephesus supposed to do the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2? They can't do anything at that particular point. They got to hear it first, don't they? Now, if there were Jews from Ephesus on the day of Pentecost and they became Christians and they went back to Ephesus, maybe things would spread. Maybe Christianity would go forward. But, you know, it didn't really happen until Acts 19 when Paul went there, right? That we know of. So God gave them grace. That's why we have that 40-year time period. But my point being is that by the time Revelation's written in the 90s, Jerusalem's been destroyed. The gospel has gone out. There's no more excuse. And now these guys are fighting against Christians. They're coming after him. And he says, that's a synagogue of Satan. They say they're Jews, but they're not. They lie. So that's what Jesus says. And I'm not going to argue with him. We just have to understand the context of what he's saying and understand how that applies today. Thoughts or questions or comments before we find out what this synagogue of Satan is going to end up doing here? All right, let's keep going. He says, I will make them come and bow down at your feet and make them know that I have loved you. That's cool. I researched this to no end. I tried to figure out, is there any indication in early church history, in early church writing, that discusses what the event was that caused this to happen? And there's nothing. I can't find anything. Which I really wish I could. That would be really cool to figure out, when did this happen. But apparently, whatever this open door was for the Church of Philadelphia, it was something so obvious where you know, like take the plagues back in Egypt. In the beginning, the Israelites, the Hebrews suffered right along with them, right? But then there was a distinction. It would happen in Egypt, not to the Hebrews. I'm thinking the same thing here. Something happened where everybody else could see that these Christians were loved by Christ. Something really obvious, and caused them to come and do a very Hebrew thing, a very Israelite Jewish thing, and bow down at their feet. Because remember, we went over this stuff. The concept of bowing down in the ancient Near East, especially in the Old Testament, was a symbol of submission. It wasn't like what we see today, and because that's really formed, you know, the Christian view of it is formed by what we see in the Bible. And in the Bible, are we bowing down to anybody? No. What happens when Cornelius and his household tried to bow down before Peter? Peter's like, get up. What happens when John, the apostle, who was so overwhelmed, he should have known better, but he was so overwhelmed by what he saw, he bowed down before the angel, right? Yeah, the angel's like, yeah, you're going to get us both in trouble. Absolutely. He's like, get up, man. I'm a servant, just like you. Because he knew what happened to the other angels that wanted that worship, and he's like, no way, buddy, just get up, right? So we don't do that. You know, there was that time a few years ago when certain organizations were going around telling people of certain color to bow down before them. Remember that? The BLM movement, when they were going around, you flushed it. Okay, that's probably a good thing. But they were going around telling people, specifically white people, to bow down before them. And a lot of white people were doing it. And it's like, absolutely not. And it wasn't a race. I don't care. I don't care if anybody said bow down before me. No, absolutely not. There's one I will bow down before, and it's not any human being. It's not going to happen. Right? So, but in the Old Testament, it was something that they did. All over the place, because that was their culture. It was the whole ancient Near East. If you're showing respect to somebody, you bow down before them. Abraham did it, right? You've got all kinds of things. You know, slaves would do that before masters. Subjects would do that before kings. So what this is showing is that these people were going to come. These Jews were going to come before the Christians, and they were going to bow down before them in submission to Jesus Christ. That's what that symbolism would mean. Not that they were saying, oh, we're worshiping the Christians, but that they would be bowing down to the Christians as representatives of Jesus Christ. I don't know when that happened. I don't know where. Maybe it had something to do after the Bar Kokhba rebellion and something like that happened. I don't know. But something was going to happen. And you could see that throughout history. You could see that throughout history. Not that people actually physically come and bow down, but there's a lot of times God can show his favor on people who honor his principles. America is a great example of this. You have a country that was started on the foundational principles of the scripture. And they took them seriously. They didn't do it perfectly. But they did it really well. They took the concepts that they found in the scripture and implemented them in a way that honored and glorified God. And what did God do? He magnified and made America great. He used America as the incubator to create, recreate, restore the first century church. And to have that go around the world. That started in America. It actually started in a town very close to where we lived in Ohio, named Lisbon. It's the first time in recorded modern history that the plan of salvation, Acts 2:38, was preached. And it was preached by Walter Scott in Lisbon, Ohio, 1850-something. Forget the actual date. Also find it interesting that as soon as the gospel starts to get restored, the Civil War breaks out. Coincidence? I don't think so. And for Walter Scott, I think every year for the next 30 years, I think that's the term or the name but or the number, but I might be getting this confused. He immersed anywhere between like 3,000 and 5,000 people a year. Talk about an open door that no one can shut. I think that would be a good modern example of it. And if you go back and look at Walter Scott and what he taught, Walter Scott taught new creation principles. He taught the power of the indwelling Holy Spirit to perfect the character. I don't think that's an accident. So my point being, these types of things happen. And so if we then go back and, you know, I'm a preacher, you know, I've been a preacher for a lot of years. I haven't immersed that many people in my life, much less in a year. You take what happened on the day of Pentecost. I've never seen that in my lifetime, where the true biblical gospel gets presented and the response is like that. So if we go back and try to say, compare ourselves to people like Walter Scott, man, we could think we're such failures. Those open doors don't last forever. You had a culture, you had a country that was very biblically literate. They knew their Bible. They were educated, much more so than we have now. They understood logic. They understood what the Bible actually had to say. You had people that would go in and convert whole congregations. They would go into a Methodist church and immerse the whole congregation into Christ. You go into a Methodist church today, they're going to have rainbow flags up. No one's going to have a Bible. Completely, in our society, completely and utterly biblically illiterate. It's a different world that we live in. We're not necessarily going to have that. We have to do so much more stuff now to get people to the point where they were when those guys lived. So what does that mean? Well, sometimes the fields are really fertile. You just throw seed out, man, and it grows, doesn't it? You don't really have to do a whole lot. Sometimes that soil is so fertile, it's just really good. Sometimes the soil's not great, and you got to work really hard. You got to till it. You got to get the mattock out and take that pick and bust up the hard clay and the soil and get the rocks out, amend the soil with some good stuff to make it grow. It's kind of what we got to do today. We got to labor over every single plant that comes up. And we got to labor really hard sometimes to get the soil ready. Sometimes you get really blessed and you find someone who's just right where they need to be. They've got that hungering and thirsting after righteousness, and you can work with them and get them into Christ fairly quickly. Others, takes a lot of work. And maybe you got to go through a lot of people before you find someone who's willing to obey. But I'm telling you what, God has placed us and created us for such a time as this. He's put the right people at the right place to do the right job. That's why I'm looking at you and not other people who are here right now. Because God chose you and me for this time to work diligently to make it happen. We are perfectly suited for our environment. That's what's great about the sovereignty of God. He doesn't make mistakes about when people exist or where. He placed you here specifically to work in this type of an environment. And before us, the doors are always open. Just might be a little bit harder work. So let's not give up. Let's not take a step back. Let's continue to push forward. Because this is why we're here. Questions or comments before we move on? Let's keep going so that Philadelphia doesn't take 3 weeks. He says, because you have kept, verse 10, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I will also keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Maybe that has something to do with why the Jews were going to recognize them, that Christ loved them. And again, I researched this. There's no indication about what this is. There's something that is missing from history that explains it. This might have been, you know, it wasn't local, obviously, because it was something that tested the whole world. I don't know if it was spiritual. I don't know. But there was something that was going to happen to these guys. You know, that happens also in the world as we move forward. Things happen all the time in the world that test the world. And Christians, we're here to make sure that we stand firm. And sometimes, because of our faith and because of the character that goes along with our faith, sometimes the world can be tested in things and we don't. Sometimes bad things happen to people in the world that Christians are spared from because of the type of life that we live, because of the things that we believe and how that manifests itself in the real world. Now, he's going to keep them from this hour of testing for a couple of reasons. Well, actually, one. He says, because you have kept the word of my perseverance. Now that word for kept means to guard or to preserve or to keep intact. In other words, you have guarded. It also has the concept of preserving. So the New American Standard does a good job here where it says, because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I will also keep you from the hour of testing. Another translation is, because you have preserved, I will preserve you. In other words, what they've done is going to manifest in what God has done. Because you've done this, I'm going to do the exact same thing. So there are times that our faithfulness, God will then protect us from things that are to come that might hit everybody else. And I think right here and now is a really, really good reason for us to hope. Look, we don't know what's going to happen in the world right now. Things are a little bit crazy. You know, growing up in the 80s and doing nuclear drills in school, you know, if you were a kid of the 80s or grew up through the 80s, and some of y'all grew up in the 70s and possibly 60s, you know, there was a lot of stuff that happened. I mean, probably the last time the world was in this shape was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did y'all live through that? Y'all lived through that, right? What's that? Oh, Dale was three? Okay. So you did. You just don't remember it. Okay, got it. I was born in 72, so that was a little bit before my time. But, you know, the world was on the brink of nuclear war then. And it almost happened. If you go back and look at the history, if I remember correctly, a Soviet sub-commander was given the order to fire and he didn't. If he would have done it, we'd be living in a very different world right now. But people throw the nuclear thing around today like it's so flippant, it's so casual. Right? And so we live in a very dangerous time, but here's the thing. We have absolute confidence in our God that only things that are within His will that are going to accomplish His purpose are going to be allowed on the grand world stage. And if they do happen, we're still able to glorify Him. He's able to protect us. And if He decides not to, then that's okay too. All the different ways we look at it, it's okay. I want to encourage you to go back and read 2 Timothy. And remember how when we've been going through Romans, I said, okay, Romans, you got, you know, in 6 years, these guys are going to be facing horrific persecution, and a lot of the people that are reading this letter are going to be dead and from really bad things. When you read 2 Timothy, I want you to understand that Paul was in probably one of the worst prisons that you could possibly imagine. At the end of the book of Acts, remember, he's in his own rented quarters, awaiting. He probably ends up being exonerated, and he ends up going around probably to Spain like he wanted to, and then came back in and went to Crete and went to several other places, and then gets arrested again during or after the fire in Rome where Nero starts persecuting the church. He and Peter both. And not at the same time, but at different times, they're in this prison in the heart of Rome. It has two levels. The first level is above ground, still really bad. The prison was about 7 centuries old, so you can imagine what it must have been like. Once they become condemned, which Paul would have been, death sentence. They get moved to the lower level. The lower level is completely below ground. It's wet. It's damp. It's dark. There's no natural light. The only way in is through a hole in the ground, a circular hole in the floor that they are lowered down on a rope. You can imagine what it felt, smelt like, and how horrible it would have been. That's where Paul and Peter stayed for weeks to a few months before they were executed. So when you read 2 Timothy, recognize where Paul was. Recognize the little things that he states in his letter that let you know exactly where his hope is and how that translates over to his attitude. I did that this week because I researched the prison, and then I read 2 Timothy. And I tell you what, it hits so much harder than it's ever hit me before. Because a lot of times you read 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus as instructions to evangelists as to how to run the congregation, how the church is supposed to run. I didn't even look at 2nd Timothy, and I recognized reading 2nd Timothy again, how little of that was actually in there. This is Paul letting Timothy know where his heart and his mind and his hope is set and how he's really hoping that Timothy is going to step up and move forward like he needs to. Because that's where people really, people, especially in Paul's position, whose life is at an end and he's in a horrible place and he's getting ready to go home to be with the Lord. The only thing that matters at that particular point is where his hope lies and what's going to happen to his work as he moves forward. That it's going to continue. God can keep us as long as he wants. And if he decides not to, it's still a victory. It just depends on where our hope is. All right, verse 11. He says, I am coming quickly. Hold fast to what you have so that no one will take your crown. Notice, they already have the crown. Recognize that. Crown is something you're going to get. But right now, it's still in your possession. It's going to be placed on your head by him. And that word for crown there
I forgot something. This is going back to the Paul thing and all the other stuff where he says, you've kept the word of my perseverance.
We've talked about this word before. Literally what it means to stay under. In other words, you've got this pressure. You've got this situation that's on you. And he's saying perseverance means to stay under that. Not trying to get out from underneath it. And I think, you know, what the word means is this. There's all kinds of pressures and situations that come upon Christians. And what ends up happening is that a lot of times people want to take the shortcut to get out of it because they don't like being in the situation. As Christians, we don't compromise to get out of a situation. We don't compromise to make life easier. We stay under it. It doesn't mean, like Paul says to a slave, he goes, if you can be free, then be free. If you can get your freedom, get it. He's not saying that slaves need to stay that way. But what he's saying is that if you're in a bad situation and you have to compromise to get out, you stay in the situation. And you rely on God for the power it takes to persevere. And he says, that's exactly what these guys did. They had little power. They were in bad situations. They kept his word. They didn't deny his faith. And they kept the word of his perseverance. They stayed under and didn't compromise. See, Sardis compromised. Laodicea compromised. Philadelphia didn't. And notice how he looks at them. From the outside world, Sardis looked great. They had a name that they were alive, but they were dead. Laodicea, oh man, these guys are wealthy. They're doing great. He says, no, you're dead too. Philadelphia, from the outside, probably didn't look very impressive. But they were better than all of them. Because they stayed under the situation and didn't compromise. And so he lets them know in verse 11, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast to what you have so that no one takes your crown. That word for crown is not a king's crown. It's the crown of a victor. Someone who wins. And he's like, you have the crown because you've won. You're in Christ. Don't give it up. Don't hand it over. Keep it. And then he says, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. Now, let's head over to chapter 21 of Revelation. We're going to wrap it up here. So what's the temple? Look at verse 22 of chapter 21. He says, I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. All right, let's put this together. Well, back in chapter 3, he says, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. But he says in verse 22 there,
He says, I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. What's that letting us know? That the Godhead is the temple, and we are inside them as pillars holding up the temple. That's who we are. We're the pillars that make up the divine temple. And it goes further. Go back to Revelation 3. He says, and I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. Remember, we're going to get a white stone on it that has a new name written on it that no one knows except us and God. And then he says, I will write on him the name of my God. We're going to get tatted up. God's going to write his name on us. I think of branding. We're going to get branded by the name of God that we belong to him. And then the new Jerusalem, the name of the city of our God's going to get written on us. And then his new name. Well, let's go to chapter 19. Look at verse 11. He says, and I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many, this is the second coming, by the way, and his eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. That name that's written on him that no one knows except himself is the same name that's going to get written on us. Because he says at the end of verse 12, and my new name. This is all amazing stuff that he's writing down here. We are the pillar in the temple, the divine temple that is made up of God and Christ. On us is written the name of the Father. On us is written the new name of the Son. On us is written the name of the city, because all of that is rolled up into one. This is the reward. I think this is what Paul's talking about when he says, I saw things in the paradise of God that I cannot tell you. I think these are the little hints that God, Jesus Christ, gives to us to let us know that we have no idea what's coming, but it's going to be amazingly incredible, and you can't even begin to understand it. Heaven is not us kicking back by our pool and our mansion in a subdivision. Hey, let's go see Jesus today, guys. Oh, cookout of four. That's not heaven. We're talking about an intimacy of fellowship that you cannot possibly imagine. This is what awaits the church. This is our victory. All right. I went over a little bit. Questions or comments?